From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Entertainers do more than entertain. They can also inspire and thrill people. For one, Savannah woman, Elvis Presley, is an inspiration, and she'll tell us about the first time she saw him in concert. And the beloved Harlem Globetrotters are pop culture icons as well. They've even starred in their own cartoon as superheroes.
So go, go, Globetrotters!
Super Globetrotters, away!
They now serve as the inspiration for a college animation course here in Georgia. That's all coming up this hour. First, though, we spoke with entertainment reporter Jennifer Brett yesterday about some movies filming here in Georgia, including the latest Spider-Man reboot.
Guardians of the Galaxy 2 finished filming, and here comes Spider-Man, so passing the Marvel baton. And wouldn't be surprised if we see a couple other Marvel stars pop up. You know how they kind of just sort of add people as production goes along. So Marissa Tomei for sure will be back for this one. She is the foxy aunt.
Not her first rodeo in
Atlanta. She was here years ago filming Parental Guidance with Billy Crystal and Bette Midler and took a real shine to Super Jenny, as I recall, back in the day. So we need to get the word out. Marissa, go to the Atlanta History Center. That's where Super Jenny is now. Welcome back to town.
We wanted to know if you've had personal encounters with a movie project here in Georgia, and here are your first thoughts. Robbie Medwed tweets, I ran through multiple scenes of What to Expect When You're Expecting back when it was filming here. And listener Sean Shaw says, Jacob's Ladder was filming on location in downtown for the last 2 weeks. We'd love to hear your stories and your thoughts. You can call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OST Talk or post on Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. The U.S. Department of Health estimates that major depressive disorder affects about 15 million Americans. That's almost 7% of the adult population in this country. Traditional treatments include prescription drugs and talk therapy. But a pair of Georgia scientists have developed a new method through the power of magnetic waves. One of those scientists is my guest today. Charles Epstein is a professor of neurology at Emory and joins me now. Hi, Charles.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us. Now, when I say it's a new method, the idea of using magnetic waves on the brain, that idea is not new. But you guys, as I understand it, have actually developed a method by which it can be feasible to do it.
We made it a little easier to do. You're right that human beings have been trying to use magnetism and electricity on our heads for as long as magnetism and electricity have been known. What we did was to make it a little easier and more efficient to use electromagnetism to employ a treatment that was developed about 25 years ago at the NIH and in South Carolina.
The National Institutes of Health. Now, I read an article from the Mayo Clinic that said the biology of why this works on depression isn't really understood. Is that correct?
That's correct, but to be perfectly honest, the biology of depression and a number of mental disorders is still not well understood.
So what exactly happens when they're using TMS or repetitive TMS on someone who has depression? What does that look like?
What we're doing basically is delivering pulses of electromagnetic energy to the left front part of the brain, an area that we know is often underactive in depression, and we are causing neurons in that part of the brain to fire, and we're juicing them up. We're making them more active, and we know that those neurons connect to other parts of the brain that are underactive in depression, and we're basically pepping up an area that is underactive, and frequently people get better.
Does the person have to be under anesthesia or anything in order for this to work?
Absolutely not. You feel a tapping sensation. On rare occasion, it's a little uncomfortable, but you're wide awake. You feel nothing else, and it's generally very easy to tolerate.
So TMS, this magnetic waves, this I also read is used when other depression treatments have not been effective. In other words, if prescription drugs are not working on someone with depression, they'll try magnetic waves. But if it's so non-invasive, why is it a last resort?
It's not a last resort. A last resort would include things like electroshock therapy, which has a terrible reputation in the movies, but is actually a highly effective treatment. Other last resorts are experimental. However, it is a lot easier to take pills. It is a lot more convenient and better for many people to do talk therapies or what are considered cognitive behavior therapies. And going into an office every day, often for weeks, to be hooked up to a complicated machine is not most people's first choice. So as one of the inventors of this system, I think it's reasonable that it not be the very first thing that people do.
What has been the response? Have you heard from doctors and institutions who are ready and excited to use the new system?
The response has been very good. At this point, thousands of people have been treated with TMS. Nothing works for everybody, but a very large number of people have benefited from this, and many of them are very happy with the results.
So, you know, when you say something like magnetism, it doesn't sound scientific, right? It sounds like we're going back to the days of Houdini when he was debunking fake science. When and how can magnets been used effectively in medical treatments? Because I know there's all kinds of products. If you go to a whole food store or a holistic place, you pick up these magnets that make all kinds of claims about what they do for the body. But how does that work when you bring magnets into the scientific field?
Well, you're absolutely right. You can find these things all over. You can find them on the internet. There are two crucial differences. The first is that we have a fair idea of what part of the brain we're influencing and what that part of the brain does and what it may not be doing exactly right when you're sick. And second, we do what are called double-blind controlled trials, where nobody, not the patient, not the researcher, not the doctor, knows whether they're getting real treatment or a placebo. So we can tell with close to absolute certainty whether what we're doing actually works. We human beings have an infinite capacity to be hopeful, to believe that what we hope for is happening, and to have placebo responses, and we absolutely have to all be blinded to be sure that our treatment actually works. That's a crucial difference.
My guest is neurologist Charles Epstein. So moving forward, what other applications do you think could be used for this, not just for this particular method, but for magnets and the effect that they have on the brain?
Well, to repeat, these are not ordinary magnets.
These are
what you might call electromagnets, which are incredibly powerful. And every time they pulse, it's the equivalent of 50,000 light bulbs going off simultaneously for a tiny fraction of a second. That's one heck of a magnet.
Yeah.
But over a couple of decades, people have tried this for basically everything you and I can think of. And it looks quite promising for a fair number of conditions, psychiatric conditions and some neurologic conditions. But so far, depression is almost the only one that has received wide recognition for really clearly working and the only one that has received FDA approval with broad general use.
Thank you so much.
That's been used for migraine as well.
Charles Epstein is a professor of neurology at Emory University. Thank you so much. A pair of blue suede shoes touched down in Georgia 60 years ago this weekend. The Savannah Civic Center played host to Elvis Presley's first concert in that city on June 25th, 1956. The place was packed with fans, mostly teenagers. Elvis made his national TV debut on CBS just a few months earlier. Here's what seeing the rock and roll icon meant to at least one Georgian.
This young fellow we saw for the first time while making a movie short, we think tonight that he's going to make television history for you. We'd like you to meet him now, Elvis Presley, and here he is.
Well, get out of that kitchen and rattle those pots and pans.
My name is Dee Sutliff, and when I was 14 years old, I saw Elvis on stage in Savannah, Georgia at the Civic Center. I was so excited. It was like heaven come to my house. It was something I never, ever thought would happen to me, that I would first be in the same town as Elvis Presley, or the same building, breathing the same air. The whole auditorium was crazed. There was a tsunami of girls screaming in back of me. It incorporated rhythm and blues, rockabilly, a little gospel tinge, all with lots of body movement, very, very physical. It was very sexualized. I don't think that young girls at that age really understood what that meant at that period in time, what that sensation was about. My parents were not thrilled at all. My father, in particular, was very protective about that exposure. He thought that it was just pretty much near sinful. One thing about it was that I seemed to understand, even at that age, that you should overlook the person and accept their talent for what it is, their art.
Hi, this is Elvis Presley. I guess the first thing people want to know is why I can't stand still when I'm singing. Some people tap their feet, some people snap their fingers, and some people just sway back and forth. I just sort of do them all together, I guess.
I watch my audience and listen to them, and I know that we're all getting something out of our system, and none of us knows what it is.
That was diehard Elvis Presley fan Dee Sutliff with her memories of his first performance in Savannah 60 years ago. Dee was actually covering the concert as a 14-year-old journalist. Her uncle was editor of the Savannah Morning News at the time. Here's part of her review of the show, quote, "Even I, an ardent fan, think that Mr. Presley is a fad, but oh boy, what a fad, and will, in some length of time, go out," end quote. Dee explains why she wrote that all those years ago.
I can see that I was trying to appease my father in there by saying, oh, you know, Elvis Presley is this and that and this wonderful person who's a huge hit right this minute, but of course he won't last. He's just a flash in the pan, and there's no way that this kind of music can last. But truly, in my heart of hearts, I didn't feel that way.
To read her entire account from the 1956 show, visit gpbnews.org. The 60th anniversary of that concert is Saturday. That story was produced by GBB's Sean Powers. You can view rare images of Elvis at age 21 at the Jepson Center for the Arts in Savannah. They're on display through October 2nd. This is On Second Thought.
Emory's Dr. Carlos Del Rio compares Atlanta's AIDS problem to third world countries.
Downtown Atlanta is as bad as Zimbabwe or Harare or, you know, or Durban.
I think we all assume that being compared to a third world country is a bad thing.
We don't have anything. We got trains that go, Bob. You know, they're like from 150 years ago. We're becoming a third world country.
In a choice between first and third, we'd all choose first, right? But third world probably doesn't mean what you think it means. And when we use a word but aren't sure of the definition, you know what time it is, right? It's time to break it down.
Ooh, break it down, baby, because I want y'all all to know. Let me break it down for you again.
Break it down now.
Break it down.
When the terms first world, second world, and third world were invented, they did not refer to the economy at all. They were political distinctions. The first use of third world dates back to the early 1950s. The French historian Alfred Sauvy wrote an article about world politics. He was trying to describe the state of world politics during the Cold War, and he reached back into history to find a good comparison. He compared the Cold War era to the French Revolution.
Deacon, you have to watch this guy. His name is Napoleon. He is a very famous French dude.
In the late 18th century, France was divided into three estates. There was the first estate. That included about 130,000 people connected to the Catholic Church, mostly men. They were archbishops, friars, monks, nuns, and other ordained members of the church. The second estate was the nobility, people with titles, barons, chevaliers, dukes, and counts.
Greetings. I am the Count. They call me the Count because I love to count things.
Just a note, the Count of Monte Cristo, for example, was not a member of the Second Estate because he wasn't a real count. He just made up that title while he was incognito.
I'm a count, not a saint.
Anyway, the Third Estate was the commoners. They had no titles, they paid all the taxes, and they didn't get a lot of privileges.
Help! Help! I'm being repressed, bloody peasant! Oh,
what a historian good... Alfred Sauvy said in 1952... that the world was then divided into three factions. The first world was the U.S. and all its NATO allies. The second world was the Soviet Union, China, and its communist allies. And the third world was everyone else. So the comparison Sauvy was making wasn't about how much money any country had or how advanced they were. It was about political alliances and the nations that got left out. He said,
"This third world ignored, exploited, despised like the third estate, also wants to be something."
But as the terms First World and Third World became more common, people noticed that most of the Third World countries were former colonies. Many were underdeveloped. People started using Third World to refer to nations without a lot of industrial advancements, nations that were war-torn, whose people were poor.
"Well, I am king."
"Oh, king, eh? Very nice. And how'd you get that, eh? By exploiting the workers."
In the meantime, Mao Zedong put forth his theory of three worlds. In Mao's view, the third world included countries that had been exploited. The first world included the superpowers.
Water twin powers, activate!
The second world was the less than superpowers. That's not what most people mean when they say third world, and it does make a difference. China is part of the second world, in the Frenchman's view, but it's part of the exploited third world, according to Mao. A lot has changed since the Cold War in the 1950s. Now, many former third world countries have stronger economic growth than some of the original first world countries. Some economists call that the Great Convergence. Basically, global trade means that inequality is shrinking between nations. Their interests and economies are converging. And there's one final addition to the three-world theory, a fourth world. The fourth world includes people who don't have a nation or land defined by borders. That's like the Kurds in the Middle East or the Maoris of New Zealand. So those are the basics of the first world versus the third world. But let's get a real expert into this conversation. Nick Mars, professor of history at Oglethorpe University. Okay, so Nick, how accurate was all that?
I think you did great. I do think there are some things we might want to sort out a little bit, both in terms of what Sauvy really meant in the first place, and then also maybe how we use it today and some of the problems with using the term.
Well, first let's go back to Sauvy, who was trying to talk about the Cold War. And here's a question for me, because technically the real end of the Cold War might have been the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, but we'd started using Third World to refer to poor nations long before 89. Why?
Well, you know, in fact, Sauvy himself starts off his sort of famous article by saying that what he's referring to as the third world is what the UN was already calling the underdeveloped world. So he's defining it as essentially economically. It is an economic category as well as a political category from the get-go in his mind. And as a minor point, he actually, in sort of in jest, as he said, really saw the first world being equivalent to the first estate as really the Soviet world, which is to say, like the clergy, it was an ideologically defined world, whereas he liked to compare the industrialized West, the capitalist world, essentially to the nobility. And so there's kind of an odd inversion with the first and second worlds.
It's, okay, but since then, that inversion, I mean, when we refer to first world and third world, and very few people even talk about the second world or the fourth world, for that matter, when we're talking about first world and third world, we're talking about rich and poor for the general public. Isn't that fairly true?
It is true. And in terms of how Sauvy was understanding that basic distinction and his comparison to the French Revolution, he was really on the side of the Third World in the sense that the Third Estate, especially from a Frenchman's perspective, writing in 1952, he was saying the Third Estate was the inheritor of the sort of champion of modernity, of progress, and that the Third World was going to necessarily be that. So he was really, that the distinction between wealthy and poor, he was really saying that the wealthy was a condition of privilege, which ultimately was not going to be tenable in terms of history in the long run.
Although it also had an implication of exploitation when we talk about first world and third world, and especially as we move forward away from Sauvy, closer to today, closer to the end of the Cold War, we were talking about former colonies. We were talking about a first world that had become rich on the backs of the third world.
You're exactly right. And in fact, the sort of post-colonial thought about what we sometimes call the third world is the notion that these different sort of categories of first and third world are, first of all, kind of have a linear relationship in terms of the third world presumably aspires to be like the first world, but also that the first world somehow got ahead by exploiting the third world and that there's a necessary sort of competitive element into this relationship. Nonetheless, his point about the third world being despised, I think what he's getting at and what I think still the term kind of resonates with us in some of the clips that you used, is the idea that the third world somehow is partially responsible for its own condition, and that the first world then either can pat itself on the back for being ahead or feel guilty for having exploited in that kind of view, but also finally, I think, kind of embrace some sort of noblesse oblige idea that the first world should now do right and help the third world in this kind of missionary uplift, which is also problematic for a variety of reasons.
Robbie Medwed tweets this to us. That he says he's called things third world many, many times, both ironically and seriously. If you've ever described something as the third world and you want to tell us how accurate that was, if you think that term is offensive, you can tweet us at OST Talk or join the conversation on Facebook. My guest is Oglethorpe University History Professor Nick Marr. Now, the terms first world, second world, third world have fallen out of favor with a lot of historians and economists and political scientists. Why is that?
Well, you know, I think there's two reasons. One is partly because it never was a very precise term in the first place, that it was never really that much.
Yeah, the
in
fact that
favor.
We're having this much right. discussion over what it
exactly.
means.
Exactly. But I do think that with the end of the Cold War, the idea that whatever we might think the Second World was, that somehow it was no longer in play. And so the idea that there was just first and third was a problem. I think that there's sort of two different ways of looking at whatever currency the term still has. One is that if you self-identify as from the first world and you refer to the third world, it is usually in a pejorative sense. Something along the lines of, you know, I don't know, the sort of recent claims that, I don't know, that Atlanta is becoming like the third world in terms of an HIV crisis. Or if you think of it in the way we use it as an adjective in almost anything, if you add it to third world politics, third world violence, third world education, in almost every sense, we're using that as a pejorative term. If, however, you self-identify as living in the emerging or the developing world or the global south or the third world, however you might define it, you might be using it in a more positive. You might put a positive spin on it in the sense that you're part of the third world because you're opting to sort of seek some third way, that there's still some history to be done, and that maybe it like the Third Estate, was an important sort of world historical group, the third world can be that still.
And there's also a sense among many, certainly many articles that I read, this sense that perhaps those in the so-called third world have an opportunity to move forward and develop without making the mistakes they think first world countries made.
No, you're exactly right. And that there can be a couple of different ways that might proceed. One is sort of this idea that maybe it is the path to progress, to economic progress, to social justice might be different, and different at least in the sense of not being dependent on the, I don't know, favors of the first world. And if you look at, you know, recent sort of trade relations within the sort of self-identified global South, a lot of that trade is increasing because they're trading with each other. And, you know, from 1980, where the global South had about 8% of its trade internally, the global South now trades within itself close to a quarter of its trade, about 23%. So there is a sort of sense that they can, the third world as such, can develop without necessarily an increasing dependence on the first world.
So then let's talk about what the fourth world is, because that's a relatively recent term that has been used to talk about certain political distinctions. What is the fourth world?
You know, the fourth world, there's been actually a number of different definitions that are offered. And I think that, you know, the first one is the one that you cited in your intro, this idea that there are these peoples essentially without geographic states. It sometimes is used today to refer to essentially those that might live in circumstances which we would equate with a developing world, but they're living within the nation states of the first world. So the kind of, you know, pockets of urban or rural poverty that we have in the United States sometimes are referred to as the fourth world.
Which, again, brings us back to why we're talking about this from Georgia at all, which is that not only has Donald Trump compared the U.S. to possibly becoming a third world country, but specifically here in Atlanta, we have an HIV crisis. And there have been some who said the HIV crisis in Atlanta is worse than any many third world nations, which would imply that there are these pockets that you were describing of as the third world. Maybe they're not comparable to the third world. Maybe they are a fourth world.
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right in that the sort of the idea of the first world as somehow this kind of monolithic and thing-like success story is often also another problem. Sort of, it's not only a problem to talk about the third world, it's kind of a problem to talk about the first world, because it often neglects what even back in 1962 Michael Harrington referred to as the other America, this idea that there are those who really do not enjoy the benefits of the standard of living that you might see if you look at the sort of big numbers of GDP or GNP or income sort of average income, that those who really are not enjoying those benefits somehow constitute this other America, which is this ongoing problem. And it's not just true in the United States. A lot of developing countries also have these embedded kind of invisible communities of those who really are not benefiting this sort of the same as the averages might indicate.
So what's a better term to use then? Let's say that I am trying to make Americans understand how severe the problem of poverty is here, or the problem of HIV infection in Atlanta. And I don't want to use the term as bad as a third world country. Is there a better way to make that, to put that in context?
You know, it's a really good question. I think that there's, you know, it kind of is one of these questions that we want to be very careful about how we speak about it, because we don't really essentially want to offend any people, but also we don't want to diminish or kind of reduce the complexity of a problem. So, there's an academic journal called Third World Quarterly, and I, just out of curiosity, I was, you know, looking it up. It started in 1979, and it still is a flourishing journal. And they, in their own mission statement, actually, they seem to prefer the term emerging nations. Even developing nations has a bit of a problem, the idea that somehow they're undeveloped, as if this is some 21st century version of a kind of civilized versus uncivilized, that it's developed versus undeveloped, that emerging has some popularity. There are those who have put forth this idea that we should refer to, in the kind of spirit of Sovi, the majority world, that it is the majority of the population that live below the kind of standard of living of the first world. The one observation I have, I guess, is that if even in that the recent CDC discussion of the HIV crisis in Atlanta, they don't use the term third world. And in fact, I think the professor from Emory does not use the term third world. It's the media often uses it as a shorthand. So if you mention an African country, then the media will often sort of just, I don't know, translate that into this term, the third world. I think it often comes from politicians in the media, and it's very rare that sort of, I don't know, the kind of scholarly world would use the term these days because it's so fraught with the kind of baggage of history.
Well, this media person won't be using it anymore. That is Nick Marr. He's a professor of history at Oglethorpe University. Nick, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been a real pleasure, Celeste. Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The Harlem Globetrotters once starred in a short-lived animated TV show. That was 44 years ago. The team, though, may return to the airwaves with help from students at the Savannah College of Art and Design. A new animation class at the college uses the Harlem Globetrotters as character inspiration for their special project. And the Harlem Globetrotters are not in Harlem, if they ever were at this point. Their headquarters now is in Georgia. Here to talk more about this is Lee Todd. She oversees the sponsored projects at SCAD. Hi, Lee.
Hi.
Also with us are SCAD students Scott Callison. Hi.
Hello.
And Carlos Soler.
Hey, how are you?
And we are in the presence of Globetrotter royalty today. Georgia's own Moose Weeks has been a member of the team since 2012.
Royalty, thank you. Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning. This conversation is another installment of our Lessons from Left Field series. That's where we highlight unique and innovative classes taught in Georgia. I have to start with you, Carlos, because you're from Columbia. So you,
yes,
when they told you about this class, you didn't even know what a Globetrotter was.
Yeah. So at the first moment I heard about them, I was like, what's the Globetrotters? Because I used to have like the concept in Spanish, like they called it Los Trotamundos de Harlem. So for me it was like, what's the Globetrotters? Then I just did a quick Google search. And I was like, oh, these are the guys. So then
so you recognized them once you saw
pictures
of
them.
And Moose is actually wearing the iconic uniform. He's posing, which doesn't work on radio all that well. But Moose, did you watch the animated series? Did you ever see any episodes of the original animated series?
Absolutely. It's crazy that you say that because, at first I saw the Globetrotters on Scooby-Doo, and then, of course, the Globetrotters actual cartoon that was running in the 70s. And, my teammates always joke like, oh, what are we pulling out of Moose's hair? Because, the superhero on the show.
He was always pulling stuff out of his fro.
That comparison is pretty funny when I'm interacting with my teammates. So,
Lee, why the Globetrotters? Of all the things you could make an animated show about?
Well, the Collaborative Learning Center at SCAD puts together real-world projects with corporate partners so that students get to gain that professional experience to help them prepare for their careers. So in this case, we had a class of animation students. We had the Harlem Globetrotters who were looking for innovative ideas in animation, so it was a perfect partnership.
Okay, so Scott, now that brings us to you. Were you planning to go into animation once you leave school?
Oh, absolutely. I've been planning to go into animation since I knew what animation was.
Probably, I don't know, when does that happen? 3 or 4 years old?
Yeah, well, when you first see Bugs Bunny.
So even earlier.
Exactly.
But how does it help you then as an emerging animator to have the subject of your animation right there as opposed to like a Bugs Bunny where that you just can make him look any way you want? You can make him move any way you want.
Well, you get to know these people a little bit better, and you get to know the reality of them and the intricacies and all the things that make a Globetrotter a Globetrotter. So rather than coming up with everything out of your imagination, you have a little bit of reality to base everything in.
So, Moose, what does make a Globetrotter? I mean, what do you think is, say, the personality, the inherent characteristics of the Globetrotters?
Well, for the last 90 years, we've been coined the clown princes of basketball. And so when we came to SCAD and we got to actually visit with the students and kind of tell them stories about what we do and how we interact with one another, with our fans, and, capturing all of the athleticism and crazy things that we do all the time, they did such an amazing job making a visual for that in the animation world.
Yeah, so you have seen clips of the animated special that they're working on.
Well, I've seen quite a few things, and I can't spill the beans here, but
no, right?
It's just really amazing.
You're happy with the way you look animated?
Well, I've it's hard to mess up this face, you know. I don't care which way the pen strokes, you know. It's going to be hard to mess it up.
I appreciate that. I actually animated Moose, so I appreciate that.
Oh, that's great. So Carlos, what do you think are the inherent characteristics that then translate between this real people playing basketball into an animated series?
Well, for us, it was like what you were mentioning, that when you create something like Bugs Bunny, you have like the freedom to do whatever you want. But it's exactly the same doing that with a real people, because that's the beauty about animation, that you don't have limits. So if you want to make Moose fly, you can do it because you don't have those limits. So for us working
Scott,
with
does Moose fly?
I haven't done that yet, but I could.
Yeah, you should try. So working with them was really beautiful because we were like part of the family. And actually, it was more than just making them play basketball. So we got to learn the actual essence of being a Globetrotter, that is just making fun and be happy and entertain all the time and just make everyone feel like comfortable around you. So it was really nice and beautiful to get that idea through our drawings and our designs.
Do you play basketball?
I used to a long time ago, but not anymore.
Scott, do you play basketball?
Oh, no.
So I guess Moose is the only one in this room, unless you, Lee, can sink a shot.
No, I'm more of an audience member.
From SCAD's point of view, what are you hoping that students walk away from in this class that they wouldn't walk away from in a different animation class?
With these projects, our mission at SCAD is to prepare talented students for their professional careers. So again, this puts them ahead of the game to have a real client.
Pardon the pun.
Working, exactly. Mm. Have a real client working on a real project, learning the skills to present, pitch ideas, get feedback, and then refine their ideas. And so it really is a collaborative process. And as they said, the Harlem Globetrotters became family throughout. So they were very involved and very supportive, but also helped guide the students to achieve those outcomes.
For just joining us, my guests are Lee Todd. You just heard her. She oversees sponsored projects at the Savannah College of Art and Design. And we have SCAD students Scott Callison and Carlos Soler. And finally here in the studio is Harlem Globetrotter Moose Weeks. We're talking about an animation class at SCAD that's working to develop a TV series based on the Harlem Globetrotters. And we would love to hear from all of you out there. I don't know if you remember the original 1970 series or you don't, but what animated show would you want to bring back to TV? If it's not the Globetrotters, what cartoon would you want to bring back to television? You can tweet us now at OST Talk. So Lee's talking about them interacting with clients, Moose. You're the client.
Yes.
How did you give, I mean, what kind of feedback did you give?
Well, you know, they wanted to know more of what, you know, how Globetrotters go about their life, not just on the court, but also, you know, when we get on the tour bus, when we're traveling, and things that we might encounter throughout our travels. So, you know, sharing stories about, stretch not being able to fit in an elevator and or always, you know, bending down, and they were able to incorporate that, or having a teammate that has a bed of pillows on the tour bus.
There is a teammate who has a bed of pillows on the tour bus?
Well, yeah. Don't ask me where he gets the pillows, but he's got about 10 of them, and he'll lay on them. He finds a way to get comfortable. We actually had somebody put an air mattress on the put an air mattress on the tour bus.
There's a lot of weirdness associated with your sleep patterns, sounds like.
Yes, absolutely. Especially, you know, you play a game, and then you're headed up right to the next city right after that game, so trying to make that tour bus your home away from home, and then, you know, living out of a suitcase, and just the interactions, how we kind of pick at each other as teammates. And they, I mean, when you're saying it, it sounds like it would be a lot more difficult than what they made it look to put it, you know, on paper or on a film. Like
they, you mean they made it look easy?
I wouldn't say they're amateurs. I thought they were professionals already, you know. That's how good it is. It's really, really amazing.
Scott, how easy was it? I mean, you made it look easy, but it couldn't have been that easy.
They made it easy in that they were a really fun client to work with, so it was a project of passion.
But it's still homework, right?
Well, yeah, it's still homework, but it's homework that you enjoy. It's something that you go back and you go, oh, this is something I really want to do. This is a lot of fun. This is something that I can really, you know, have fun with and develop and come up with something that's going to be awesome.
How much of it is hand-drawn and how much is done through the computer?
Well, we hand-drew everything on the computer. So half and half, I guess, but we use tablet screens.
That counts. It's not CGI.
Yeah, it's not CGI. Everything was hand-drawn, and we use tablet screens called Cintiqs to draw everything. So it's all hand-drawn look, but it's done digitally.
Carlos, did you go back and watch some of the original series?
Yes, we did. We actually, some of the first ideas, like when we were starting, we tried to just define the visual style of the thing. So we were just getting that nostalgia of those first series.
Yeah, it looks like it was made in the 70s.
So yeah, we were looking at that because that was like a huge inspiration, just not for us, but for some of the team players. Like we had the first meeting we had with Handels, one of the team players, and he told us about it, how he got inspired to actually dreaming about being a Globetrotter by that series. So that was like a huge thing for us. Like we got connected immediately. So that was the moment when we felt that we were in the same ship together.
What did you like? Was there parts of the style that you retained, or did you just completely start from scratch and have a very modernized look?
We have everything in the range. Like the main plan was to create just like the first line, just one line up. The whole class created just one line up, but we
one
got
one line up. What does that mean?
So that means that we have a version of each character. So we have five players and a coach. That was the first idea. But we got so excited working with this that each one of us created a lineup. So we have 14 different versions, like for 14 different ideas for a 14 different series. So
full series.
Yeah, we have like the concept and the character designs for 14 different versions of
it. How do you know which one wins?
We don't know yet.
Lee?
We won't know. That's for the Harlem Globetrotters to see where this goes. But what was exciting about this project is we did have 14 students in the class, all animation students, and that each student was encouraged to develop their own idea. So as Carlos just said, by the end of the course, each student had created a lineup of players, so their own team with a coach. Many of them had young recruits as part of that team as well. And then they created a preliminary story that backed up those characters. So there was actually an environment that those characters lived in. And then they presented those ideas to the Harlem Globetrotters. So 14 different, very original, very innovative ideas.
So Moose, I just want to put in my vote because I understand there was one series in which they were teaching monsters to play basketball. I totally vote for that one. Man, that's a winner to me.
That was actually pretty cool. I mean, all of them were so amazing, and just to see the thought that they went through, like everybody, they did their homework. You could tell they were well researched, and they made it unique to almost every, you know, player, like every Globetrotter. So I think that when my teammates, because everybody hasn't got to see it. I got a little special insight, but you know, I think they're going to be just so thrilled to see how much and how relevant it is to what we do and who we are. So
now your Globetrotters bio says you are in basketball because your mother, who was born in Trinidad, was a basketball player. Is that accurate?
Yes.
And so how, I mean, did she come from Trinidad? Did she have any idea who the Globetrotters were when she got here?
Well, being a basketball fan, my mom, she always was, you know, watching as much as she could and you know, listening to the game. And I never asked her if she knew back then when she was a child about the Globetrotters. She did when she got to America. I know she was very familiar with the Globetrotters.
Okay. So by the time you actually became a member of the team.
She had known well before then that.
Super fan.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm just wondering, I assume that the point is to take this animated TV series someday to the TV so that people can
later.
Watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. What will that be like when you sit down with your family to watch animated Moose Weeks on TV?
You know, that would be just amazing to see. Sitting down Saturday morning, eating breakfast, watching cartoons, having my kids or family members just laughing at me or saying, hey, that's you, that's Moose.
Yeah.
You know, that's just an amazing feeling. And especially as much as I loved the cartoon growing up, I think it's been well past time for us to get back on the screen. And just another way to reach the younger audience that doesn't really know that much about the Globetrotters, try to just make us, you know, more relevant to today's youth as we were back in the 70s and
I was a big fan. Curly Neal was my favorite. So, Scott, what happens when you walk away from this class and you pass, I have to assume, and
I would hope so.
You walk away from the series? Is that going to be a difficult thing for you to do?
A little bit. I mean, it's a little bit like, you know, sending your baby off to college. But we hopefully can, you know, continue to work with the Globetrotters. They've got all of our contact info, so you guys should call us.
Yeah.
And, I hope that if they don't call us, they get someone just as talented as us to come in and develop these concepts further, because there are 14 fantastic concepts. Everyone did an A-rate job, and if one of them doesn't make it to air, it would be a complete shame.
Carlos, are you hoping to eventually continue working on it?
Yeah, of course. Like we were talking about this like a couple of times before, and even if our personal proposal and idea is not the one that is selected, we will be really happy if any of those ideas are selected, because we work together as a team, working like making them happen. So it was really like special for us to collaborate and just to share our opinions, because in every single class we were looking at each other's work and just saying, like, making our points and making big decisions and how to make every single idea better.
My guests, I've been speaking with Harlem Globetrotter Moose Weeks. We also heard from Lee Todd. She oversees sponsored projects at the Savannah College of Art and Design, and SCAD students Scott Callison and Carlos Soler. Thanks so much to all four of you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
That's our show for today, but tell me what your favorite cartoon was. I was really into DuckTales and Scooby-Doo, but what did you watch on your Saturday mornings while you ate your Cheerios? Call us at 404-500-9457. Tweet us at OST Talk. Or post on Facebook. Our show is produced by Sean Powers and Linda Chen with help from Taylor Gant. Lindsay Foster Thomas is our senior producer. Our engineer is Jacob Bokey, Ryan Thomas. And Tanya Ott is our VP of radio. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day. I like slam dunks and taking it to the hoop. My favorite play is the alley-oop. I like the pick and roll. I like the give and roll.